and welcome to this session, The Law of Attraction. Raymond Halliwell said, to desire is to expect. To expect is to achieve.
Bob, I have a story I want to share here that fits in perfectly with this law. I took my granddaughter, she's 7, to Disneyland and to California Adventure, and she is a little daredevil, and she saw a roller coaster that she wanted to ride, a big, giant roller coaster that goes from 0 to 60 in 4 seconds, has big loops, and she wanted to ride that roller coaster. I frankly was hoping that maybe she was a little too short, but when we got there, she was tall enough. And so she said, I want to ride this. We got in line. It was a 30-minute wait. We were in line no more than 5 minutes, and she turned around and she said, my tummy's feeling a little funny. I'm not sure I want to ride this. And I said to her, well, Allie, you don't have to ride this. It's okay with me. We'll take this exit. And then she said, well, Emma, how do you make yourself think so the part of you that wants to win can get over the part of you that's afraid to win? How do you make yourself think so that you can have what you really want instead of being afraid and having that get in your way? And I thought, what a great question, not only for a 7-year-old, but for all of us. How do we make ourselves think so that the good we desire can be in our lives? And that's what this lesson is about.
I think that's exactly how Raymond Halliwell opens this lesson. He said, the underlying law that regulates supply in the world of effects has two important phases. One is desire, and the other, expectation. And he said, these mental attitudes represent lines of attractive force, the former being the positive phase of the law, and the latter the negative phase. Well, phases must be complied with to obtain the best and greatest results. The first phase of desire embraces a positive process of attraction. That is, when an individual earnestly desires a thing, he sets up a line of force that connects him with the invisible side of the good desired. Should he weaken or change his desire, that particular line of force is disconnected or misses the goal. But if he remains constant in his desire or ambition, the good demanded is sooner or later realized in part or in entirety. The principle involved is that you cannot long or yearn for anything unless it already exists. If not in form, then in substance. And desire is the motive power for calling it forth into visible appearance or physical effect. Well, there are millions of levels of vibration, which is based on the law of vibration. There are millions of frequencies. So everything is on one frequency or another. When we desire something, what we do is we put ourselves on the frequency that that good is on. It's like a radio. You turn on your radio station, you get the music or the talk that's on that particular frequency. Well, when we desire something, we put our mind on the frequency of the good that we desire. So desire hooks us up. Now, he says it's no use to desire a thing unless you expect it, either in part or in full. Desire without expectation is idle wishing or dreaming. You simply waste much valuable mental energy in doing this. Desire will put you in touch with the inner world of causes and connect you by invisible means with the substance of the thing desired. Then, continuous expectation is necessary to bring it into a reality in your life. Much like the pull of gravity in the physical realm, expectation is a drawing force of the mind which acts in the invisible realm. I think it starts when we're small. We are not taught or programmed to expect the good that we desire. It's just not for us. Or a saying that is quite common, it's too good to be true, which is an absolutely ridiculous statement. How could anything be too good to be true? But we have been trained not to expect quantum leaps, great changes in our results. Instead, we're to expect small incremental increases. And if we have a job, it's only when we're in favor of whoever is making the decisions.
Yet, when we use the radio metaphor, we do expect, when we turn from one channel to another, a dramatic shift in the programming or the experience. And if we could just keep that metaphor in mind, that if we can really stabilize the frequency of our desired good in our feeling state as well as in our mental state, we become much more attractive, and time collapses. It doesn't take a long time when we stabilize that frequency.
What you've just mentioned there is really a key here. Like you were saying before, that's huge. Well, what you just said is huge. Not just use it as a metaphor, let's understand the principle that governs that. And then realize that the same principle governs what we do in our thinking and how we attract things in our thinking.
I had the opportunity to meet Nelson Mandela one time and just a few years ago and deliver a Gandhi Peace Award to him. And he told a story about how when he was in the cell after being told he would be imprisoned for life at hard labor for having fought for the ending of apartheid. And at first, all he could think was his good would never happen. His goal would never happen. He filled his mind with, it'll never happen now. It'll never happen now. It'll never happen now. And then one day he said it was as if a stream of light landed on a parched field. The thought came through, maybe it could still happen. And he nurtured that thought and he began to hook to that thought and embody that thought. And then the thought came, well, maybe this is what it looks like while it's happening. And as he began to hold the thought, maybe his being in prison had meaning towards the ending of apartheid or his desired good. And every one of us listening to this lesson has a desired good right now in mind. In the physical absence of its presence, we begin to practice relating to its presence at a frequency of being, which is existent now only in our mind, but by our expectation has to come into form. And he began to think, okay, this is what it looks like while it's happening. My being here is part of it. And he said once he got to that frequency, the idea of writing letters occurred to him. And it was through his letter writing that the American media picked things up and, you know, the rest of the story. But it began with one man in prison refusing to succumb to the circumstance and opening his mind to joining with his desire, matching that in his feeling tone, and from that, answers and solutions began to arrive.
You telling that story reminded me of a story that I had shared a long time ago in a radio program. I was forever writing these radio shows, and I was flying over Kentucky, and I was low enough I could see the ground, but I was high enough that everything was dwarfed. And as I looked down, I saw the houses. They didn't even look as big as the houses on a Monopoly board. And I was thinking how insignificant they look relative to the whole scheme of things from up there in the plane. And then I thought what people go through sometimes just so they can say they own a little piece of land, when in truth they never own it. Nobody can own the land. We think we own the land. The land actually owns us. And at the same time those thoughts were running through my mind, I thought of a Persian proverb about a bug in a rug. The story goes that there's this little bug that's crawling around a rug, and the tufts of wool stand like giant trees all around the little bug. So when it gets past one tuft of wool, another one, whack, it hits it. And the bug is forever trying to get between these tufts of wool to get to a crumb that somebody's dropped to eat. And the tufts of wool loom above them like giant problems. Now, if the bug could raise itself up above the rug and look down on it, it would see what it conceived as problems as being part of a beautiful woven plan. But the bug can't see that. And you know, I often think we live like a bug in a rug. Mandela was living like a bug in a rug. He was just looking at the problems that surrounded. But when the light came to him and he raised himself up above the rug, Don Blanding called that in a poem the God's Eye View. Mm-hmm. And then he would see that the problems were part of a beautiful woven plan that's our life. And so rather than live like a bug in a rug, we ought to be operating with the God's Eye View. And when we do, then we start to see how this law of attraction really works in our life. Like we all know, many persons desire good things which they never expect nor make any effort to grasp. And we have to ask ourselves, why would we possibly do that? Well, of course, I think the answer is conditioning is bad conditioning, and we've got to change that.
So then the application is the test of adequacy, because knowledge of all of this is of little value if it's not used to practical ends. So here's a simple method, and these are Dr. Hollowell's words. Here is a simple method in the beginning for using the power of mind to increase the amount of good in our lives in conformity with the law. form a clear and well-defined mental picture of what you want. Do not specify its particular form or how it shall come, but simply desire firmly and gently the greatest amount of good in that direction. Avoid a tense state of mind or any condition of strain or anxiety. It is better to do your mental picturing, maybe even in odd moments when you're quiet and you're in a quieter, restful condition. But let the idea or plan of good unfold into a vivid mental picture, much the same as though it were a moving picture upon a screen. Don't force the thought. Pressure causes congestion, confusion. The calmer, the more peaceful we are, the better the results. So the main thing here is to hold the thought. Then proceed to nourish the desire or want with a calm and confident conviction that what you seek will come. And also, what you seek is already here. It's here. It's right where you are, just at a different frequency, and your connecting to it actually brings it into time.
If you tie that in with what we were just talking about a moment ago, I've often in seminars used this desire expectation as a concept. If you can imagine yourself fishing and you cast a line out, sometimes as soon as the line hits the water, the fish bites and you got the fish on the end of it. But you'll never see that fish if you don't reel it in. So when we say that desire hooks us up to the good, expectation draws it to us. Well, then the test here that Raymond Hollywell is talking about, the test of adequacy, then it really starts to take some form. We can see how this works. If everything's here and I desire, I connect to it, and then I expect it to come into my life. I think probably the greatest struggle I had when I first started to win was expect the good to continue. It was like it was temporary. Because I think most people have good in their life. I think all people do. But with most, it comes in waves, or it comes periodically. Not very often, but it does come. And I had a difficult time really grasping the idea that it was continuous. And of course, that was because I never understood the law. And the more I understood the law, the more I started to see that it would not only continue, but the more I understood it, the greater would be the flow. When you proceed to nourish your desire or want in a calm, confident conviction that what you want, you seek, will come, as you persist in this state of mind, the good desired will tend to gravitate toward you. Earl Nightingale used to say, as you move toward your goal, it moves toward you. Now, it may come almost at once, as in respect to the little things of less consequence, like an invitation, a book, or a meeting a friend on the street, or it may come by degrees over a period of time. But it frequently happens, you know, just as I'm saying that, where you have a desire to talk to a friend. You may not say, I'm going to expect them to call me, but your attitude is one of expectation, because you start carrying on a conversation with that person, and in nothing flat, the door rings, the phone rings, or you get a letter from them. And this works in everything in our life, but according to the clearness and strength of your demand and the particular form of good desired, it's going to come in different stages. But that's all according to our thinking. In the meantime, we want to be reasonable and practical and do what we can to promote its coming. I have little confidence in the Lord answering the one who rocks in an easy chair and waits for the desired good to be placed in their lap. It just doesn't happen. It's like a person sitting at the bottom of the hill and praying that they could get to the top.
Somewhere it says that the Lord helps them who help themselves. And I actually think another word for Lord is law. That when we get in harmony with the law, it's already in operation. We just get in harmony with that operation. So I'm wondering if the people that we were speaking about who actually feel, well, here comes a wave of good, if for a moment they just drop their resistance to the good, and then as soon as the good starts happening, they build their resistance back up, thinking that the good can't last.
I think Hollywell gave us some good instruction. He says, only desire that which will round out your life to make it fuller and happier, and also that which will enable you to help others into a better and happier condition. Aim to be normal in your demands and use the intelligence with which God has endowed you in discriminating between rational and irrational demands. Now, you see, That is a point that you could talk about for a long time.
Yeah.
What is rational and what's irrational? The Wright brothers were irrational insofar as the masses were concerned, but they were very rational in their own thinking. So what we have to do is differentiate between what other people think and expect and what we think and expect. If we can see it in our mind, then we know we can do it. That is rational for us. It may be irrational to someone else. Now, the innate desire of your being is for harmony, satisfaction, and plenty. These conditions will be obtained more and more in your life as you live in accordance with the law and constantly expect a continuous increase of good as an evidence of your growing faith in the wisdom and all sufficiency of the great source of all good. That's where I was mentioning I was having problems when I first really got into this. And of course, that lasted for quite a long time because I never understood that I was dealing with an infinite source of supply. I just knew that there was a lot more than what I had because I could see many people with it. And of course, I had a desire to have more. And so from a rational perspective, if you did it and you had it coming, then why couldn't I get it? That thought did cross my mind. But what we're talking about here, you don't even have to govern yourself what you see other people doing. You can go well beyond that. Like the Edmund Hillarys and the Wright brothers and the Edisons have nothing going for them that you and I don't have going for us. And we want to really understand that. Mary, you were talking the mind is a magnet and as such attracts whatever corresponds to its ruling state.
Whatever we image in mind, whatever we expect and think about, will tend to bring into our lives the things and conditions that are in harmony therewith. Science has convincingly proven the existence and the constant operation of the law of mental attraction. For this reason, each one of us should be doubly careful about how and what we think, because our predominant mental attitude is the primary cause of most everything that comes into our lives. And the sooner we realize this truth, the sooner we shall begin to improve our lives and progress. And I would just say to those listening to these ideas, you may believe this now. This may be brand new to you. When Marconi suggested that there were invisible waves that transmitted sound, he was put in a mental institution. The idea that we are operating in a life that is both visible and invisible, that there are physical laws and there are laws of mind and spirit. If you're wondering if this is true, just test it out. Put your mind in harmony with the good you seek to desire. Begin to expect it. And notice if you don't begin to experience ideas, things begin to occur. People say things that are in harmony with your desired good. Have you ever decided you wanted to buy a red car and all of a sudden you see red cars? Have you ever been hungry and you walk down the street? What do you see? You see everything there is to eat that we attract by our interest and our desire. So when we put a desire and we have an expectation, just begin to notice that that law has been put in operation through your practice, and you can expect that you will learn that this works, and it works every single time.
I like the way Holywell put it. He says, the law of mental attraction acts along the same lines as the law of gravity. It's as definite and as accurate. And you see, if you violate the law of gravity, you're going to pay. Well, isn't it strange that we train little children to work in harmony with that law? And that's about the only one that I know of that we really train them in harmony with. If a baby crawls off a balcony 10, 15 stories up on a building, it's going to go down, get hurt, or get killed. Nobody blames the law. Everybody blames the parent or the guardian who was ever supposed to be watching that baby. But they know that anything heavier than air is going to be attracted towards the center of the world. Well, if we start to understand the laws, we're going to know that the only thing that can be attracted to you is that which vibrates in harmony with you. Of course, that's the way it works. The law of attraction's always working. It's a secondary law in truth. The law of vibration is the law, and the vibration you're in dictates what you're going to attract. Now, you've heard the law expressed in such statements as birds of a feather flock together, like attracts like, or things equal to the same thing are equal to each other. Well, the thoughts and actions of people draw to them people of their own type and kind. If you look in welfare areas, you're going to find that almost all welfare recipients are third, fourth, fifth generation welfare recipients. I used to go into maximum security prison in Canada one Saturday a month. I did that for about 5 years. And so I got to understand something of the psyche of the prisoner. They're thinking crime, and they expect to go back. When the prisoner leaves a maximum security prison, the guard will usually say, "You'll be back," and they'll say, "Don't hold your breath." But they know they're going back. The guard's not the only one who knows they're going back. They know they're going back. And 85 to 90 times out of 100, that's exactly what happens. The recidivism rate is ridiculous. But birds of a feather flock together. They're amongst criminals. What do they talk about? Crime. Why did they talk about it? Because that's what they're thinking about. That's what they have in common. And, of course, they maintain that kind of life, and they go where people that maintain that kind of life go. They're attracted to people like themselves.
So Hollowell then says to us, it's difficult to tell each one of us just exactly where we may be off track with our thinking. But nevertheless, we don't have to worry about where we're off track with our thinking. We just need to get on track. And then he gives us three steps about how to get on track with our thinking so that we can work with and in harmony with the law of attraction. The first is a practice called interest, what we're interested in. Interest is paying special attention to some object or thing. It is being definitely concerned about something or someone. Interest is tending to see in the outer world what is already existent in one's mind. Things you think of that give you joy or pleasure or wisdom or satisfaction are interests. Hollowell says, I recall one woman telling me that she invariably could see disabled people in a crowd quicker than anyone else. They seemed to draw her attention and excite her sympathy. It was because she had once been injured and was wheeled about for several months packed in a cast, and the memory of the experience was fresh in her mind and created the interest. Our interests are largely individual because we don't think alike. Dr. Michael Beckwith once told me that he was driving to the church he serves over a period of time in the beginning days of the church, and there was a homeless person who would sit on the corner, and he started noticing this homeless person, and he began to get interested in wondering what would cause somebody to be homeless. And he said within a few weeks, he got a letter from the IRS demanding quite a large sum of money. There was an assessment put on his house. There was some kind of repair on the house that was going to be extremely expensive. And as he drove the next day to work and he looked at the homeless person, he realized, I have been very interested in what would cause someone to get homeless, and my life is showing me what could cause someone to get homeless. And he realized he would bless that person and wish them well and send them thoughts that they could learn to attract their own blessing and their own prosperity. But he took his attention off what would make somebody homeless, and he put his attention and his interest back in what would bring about the good that he was seeking and desiring. And he said within a couple of weeks, all of what looked like big problems absolutely dissolved. The IRS made a mistake, and one thing after another, it completely dissolved because the world is plastic to our thinking. We think it's real. It's plastic to our thinking. So what Hollowell says here is pay attention to and be careful with what you are interested in, because where your interest is, your energy flows.
The average individual, when they hear stories like you told about Dr. Beckwith, well, I really have difficulty believing that. And what they're really saying is, I don't really understand this law yet. I frequently have people come to me in a seminar talking about something they're in need of. And you can tell by the conversation that they really don't expect it to happen. But I tell them to write out exactly what they want. Now, I said, I want you to write out the way it is right now in your physical world, the way this exists. Then write out its polar opposite. And write it down by starting off by saying, I am so happy and grateful now that. So it's present tense. Write it out. Then I said, now take the negative statement that you've written out, what you don't want that you see manifest in your life right now, and burn it. Literally burn it. Now I said, that's symbolic. It's like lighting a candle, really. It's symbolic. But I said, burn it and mentally let it go. And then continually write out the other. Now, what he was doing was rewiring his brain. And what he was doing when he was letting the physical dominate his thinking, he was programming, he was wiring his brain for that. Because we do operate like radio stations, broadcasting and receiving. And if we want anything, what we have to ask ourselves is, what is it we want? What am I interested in? and then start impressing that upon my mind over and over and over again, I'm going to start to move toward it, and it is going to start to move toward me. What I'm really doing is moving into harmony with the good I desire. And so that's what he's saying here when he says our interests are largely individual because we do not think alike. One person may find interest in some things that another would fail to see. If we go back to the law of attraction again, let's say people that are interested in playing tennis, you're usually going to find them congregating around a tennis court. You'll say, well, that's natural, but why is it natural? It's natural because that's where you play tennis, but they're attracted to one another. And you'll find people at golf, they will congregate around golf courses. So what we're interested in doing is going to control where we go, what we do, and whom we're going to do it with. This is a very, very important step. And I think Hollywell has done a very good job of bringing it to our attention here.
And it isn't something that we don't know. It's sort of course when you say that about the tennis court and the golf course. But what isn't an of course is the power of knowing that.
See, I think everybody's aware of the law of attraction, whether they call it that or not. Mm-hmm. There's still an awareness factor, and how great the awareness is another thing. Awareness is something like a dimmer switch on a light. You can keep it getting brighter and brighter and brighter. Well, I think that's the way awareness happens. So we're all aware of these things, but what he's bringing to our attention here are three definite steps to get this law of attraction working in our life the way we want it to work, so we bring our life in harmony with it. It's very common that we see in life that which interests us the most, and we pass blindly by that which is of little or no interest. It's here that this simple practice that many of us may be making our mistakes. We may be so interested in things that are not prosperous, joyful, and healthy that we pass by the very things we desire most and overlook the means of our health and prosperity. With our interests so engrossed in seeing the lesser, either through habit or ignorance, we fail to attract the greater things that are all around us. People are attracted to newspapers. They're attracted to the news. Why? Because they're in harmony with what's wrong in the world. If they throw the newspapers away, turn off the news on the television, and get something like this and start to study it, their whole life would start to shift a lot faster.
A lot faster. It's so easy for people to allow themselves to get into a rut. And it's always a mental rut before it becomes a material one. When I first found these ideas, I was not only in a mental rut, I was in a material rut. I had gone through an experience in my life, and the toxic thinking I had been employing and focusing on for a period of time actually over time manifested itself in a physical way, and I had a toxic body. In fact, I was told I might not even survive it. And a woman came into my hospital room and introduced me to these ideas. And I began with an experience of healing that dramatically changed my life. And I became so interested in these things, interested in these laws, interested in these ideas, that I began to see that everywhere is evidence of the laws that we're talking about. I began to be like a thirsty sponge in the area of world religion and philosophy and ancient mysticism and world religions and all of this. And I began to see that there's an underground stream of truth that runs through all the great religions, all the great philosophies. And in science today, it is such an exciting time that science itself is evidencing that which the mystics have said for thousands of years. This law of attraction is not a new law, and it's not a new understanding. It may be new to us, and the practice of its power in our lives may be new. And I don't care where we are in our growth cycle, there is another whole octave of power awaiting each one of us as we harmonize with this law of attraction. So Hollowell's giving us three points of practice, the first of which is get interested in what you're interested in. Put your energy there.
Now, the second step in developing the law of attraction or developing a greater awareness of the law of attraction is attention. To have a high interest is not enough. We must inject this interest into our daily lives. I frequently tell people to do that when they're developing a purpose. They have to ask, what are they really interested in? What do they love? Well, then give that your attention. See, our attention must portray our interest. And the keener our interest, the more intense will be our attention. It is our interested attention that draws from the outside world such facts as are found in the mind. And as we direct our attention to our interest, this magnetizes our power of attraction, which draws to us much of the same type as our thoughts. When much of our interest is taken up with our full attention, we shall find that most of our petty and selfish leanings will be absorbed by our higher interests, and we will steadily progress. Do you know, if you really want to improve anything in your life, take those two steps and apply them. You take what you're interested in, what you're doing, and then give it your conscious attention. That's what brings about focus. That's what raises sales. That's the yeast that raises the dough. So this second step is essential. It's one that you have to follow. You've got to give it attention. Whatever you give your attention to is what grows.
I heard once that the only way the universe knows where our intention is where our attention is. So where we place our attention, whether it's for good or ill, the universe responds perfectly with the law that where we place our attention, therein lies our intention, whether it's for failure or success. Let's move to success.
The source and cause of all successes lies hidden deep within the mind, and one must give one's attention and interest to first principle and then to fact. Now, what do I mean? Good question. If you believe in honesty, then you support the principle of honesty with all of your attention. You direct this attention to do and think all things in an honest manner. If you should have an opportunity to cheat or steal from another, you adhere to your principle and refuse to take advantage of what may seem a trivial thing. They always seem trivial in the beginning, but that is only the beginning. Such trivials grow with a cancerous rapidity. You rarely see the surface record for remaining loyal to a standard. But in time, you will not only see but feel its satisfaction as you watch closely your dealings and force every issue to comply with your principle. You are charging your mind with honesty, and it becomes magnetic to attract honest endeavor and permanent success.
Next, we need to take this truth and follow it along until we have worked it in the same way. There are so many ways that truth may be challenged that you need not to expect to accomplish your work in a week or two. It requires growth. After time, you will find that your interest and attention are so taken up with truth in all its forms that you will no longer attract deceit or dishonesty to you in any of your affairs. So set up a standard or a measurement for yourself if you have not already done so. Take one thing or one thought at a time and build upon it. As you strive to give your attention to some constructive interest, naturally then we cease giving so much attention to a lesser one.
And this brings us to expectation, the last of the three steps in developing an understanding of the law of attraction. Raymond Hollowell talks about expectation. And he says the last step we take is expectation. This is an active form of attention. I love the way he put that. It is attention with intensity. It may be likened to the actions of a cat that waits patiently at the mouse hole. The cat expects to catch its prize at any moment. He expects to get the mouse because he believes he will get it eventually. If the cat did not believe and expect to catch the mouse, his interest and attention would lack the intensity which is now present. His energies would not be so actively called forth. When you believe in the probability of success in your undertaking, you experience the keenest interest in your work. This interest is intensified with expectation and anticipation. Through this, you will draw to you the success you are working for. Your expectation must be built up with your interest and attention.
There's a story in the Old Testament that Hollowell shares here about a widow who comes to Elijah and asks him to help her meet a problem of finance because there is a debt that her husband owes and her sons are going to be taken into slavery. And as any mother would be, she's desperate for an answer. And she says, I don't have the money, I don't have. And she's caught in a consciousness called the only consciousness. The only consciousness is a consciousness of I only have what I can see. And Elijah says to her, what do you have? And she says, well, I only have a little bit of oil. But Elijah recognizes that there is an abundance. So he's coming from an abundance consciousness. And you can see in this story how it works. So she's caught in lack and limitation and a big problem. Elijah looks at the circumstances and says, everything that's required is here. He says to her, go home and gather every vessel you can and begin to pour the oil out of the vessel that you do have. She goes to her friends and she gathers every vessel that she can find. And then she takes that little bit of oil and she begins to pour, and it's called the miracle of abundance. And she begins to pour that oil, and the story is that the oil pours and pours and pours and pours until every vessel that she has is filled to overflowing, and then the oil stops flowing. Why did the oil stop flowing? Because she no longer had any receptivity to the abundance that is available. In the Upanishads, again, from abundance, we scooped abundance, and more abundance remained. So when we want to engage the law of attraction, we've learned in this lesson that the law of attraction works through two phases, desire and expectation. We amplify, then, our understanding and our education in working with the law of attraction by these three practices, interest, attention, and expectation.
Raymond Holywell leaves us with some great information to close this particular session on the law of attraction. He said, when you pray for one thing and then fear and doubt that you will receive it, you diffuse your mental forces and can attract only what the lesser thoughts believe and expect. A prominent doctor was asked why it was that he was able at times to reach cases that others had failed to reach. He said, I never expect a patient to be too far gone not to survive. I fish around in my mind for some idea of what to treat. And sometimes those ideas are very simple or strange, but the moment something inside me clicks, I accept it and use it. He said he had never failed to help a patient when he firmly expected his recovery.
And Holywell goes on and he says, when we charge our thoughts so firmly with the idea that there are no failures, then we expect success. Now, this doesn't mean that there won't be apparent failures. I mean, something that happens that we consider a failure. But when we have a broader understanding, a greater view, and more harmony with the law of attraction, what we understand is everything that happens can be used for the greater good. And in fact, that which looks like a failure and at the time seemed like a failure, from the proper perspective, is information. And that information properly used then becomes part of our expected success and that which we are hoping for. And when we do that, our mind becomes strengthened with our conviction, and like a magnet, draws to us, through the principle upheld, whatever desire is uppermost at the time.
Beautiful idea, beautiful law. It's working in your life all the time. This is Bob Proctor.
And Mary Morrissey.
Thank you.